You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. This is another live episode recorded at the Gilded Balloon at the Edinburgh Fringe 2013. We've got an absolute powerhouse of a comedian for you today. One of the most consistently excellent jokesmiths in the world. This is Milton Jones. Thank you very much for joining us.
No, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Lovely to have you here. How is your show going?
Good, yeah. I'm only here for 11 nights, which feels like cheating in a way because I've done my time doing 4 weeks for ages. So, it's going very well. Yeah.
Okay.
On the Assembly Hall.
I enjoyed the show very much. Can I just ask who here has seen Milton's show this year? That's a relief, isn't it?
Yes.
But I think we can safely assume you've all seen Milton in some context or another. And the first question I wanted to ask was really about your persona and how you are on stage and how that differs from how you are in real life. Because I notice, even now, having said hello to you 2 minutes ago and seeing you sitting there now, you have adopted a slightly Milton-esque... do you know what I mean? There's something there. So let's talk about that.
I think when I first started doing comedy, I used to do it pretty much as myself.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that would really work. I mean, similar sorts of jokes. But I found out, you know, that if you did a rough club in Romford on a Monday and you sounded slightly middle class and you did clever jokes, mm-hmm. it didn't always work. So I found if I stuck my hair up and looked a bit mad, suddenly I wasn't a threat anymore.
Okay.
And those jokes began to work more regularly. So, and also, I like to think it's a bit of a signpost to say where I'm coming from in terms of the writing, in that it's a bit more left field. But there are degrees of Milton.
Sure.
I usually say, the thicker the crowd, the higher the hair has to go.
Okay. Girl, that's interesting. Because I noticed when I saw your show, which was specifically your show as opposed to a mixed bill to your audience, your hair was very low down, and I wondered if you were phasing out the hair, but that was more of a specific decision about the crowd.
No, I mean, my dad's phasing out his hair, but I'm not phasing out mine yet. No, I mean, I don't need to. Basically, big hair and big shirt gives me 10 seconds at the top.
Gotcha.
For them to tune into what I'm doing. But if they've come to see me, generally speaking, they know what they're in for. So there's no need to do that.
And was the big hair and the big shirt, was that one of several things that you tried until you got just the right thing? Were you experimenting with other possibilities?
Yes. I mean, I did go even weirder for a while. You know, like Emo Phillips goes proper weird. I sort of, you know, gurned it up.
Okay.
It was just slightly off-putting in a wrong way. And then I played around with cardigans, and but that was off stage. And jumpers, I used to do more jumpers. Shirts is quite a recent thing, actually. It's only since being on telly and the lights being too hot that I've stopped the jumpers. So, but I've always messed around with that kind of thing. But it needs to be not too, oh, that's wacky. It needs to be, no.
Sure. You've got to be subtly wrong as opposed to the crazy guy in the office.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. And just to sort of stay for a moment on the persona of Milton, I wondered if there are... And I mean, in what terms do you talk about the guy that you are on stage? Because it's you and yet it's not you.
Yeah. Well, I think most of us who do stand-up go into a slightly heightened version of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And while I'm not a complete idiot normally... there is a sense of that. I'm quite clumsy, and I quite often take a while to catch on to things, and I've just heightened the whole thing.
Okay.
And turned it into a living.
Congratulations.
Yes, contrary to all the teacher's expectations.
And do you find in situations like this or other interviews where you're being yourself, do you feel that there is some of Milton just kind of bubbling below the surface? Some of the performance, Milton?
Yes, I mean, it's a bit unconscious. There are levels of Milton that come out in terms of, if I'm just doing stand-up to a big crowd, then it's full-on one-liner, one-liner, one-liner. But then, say, something like Mock the Week, where you have to interact a bit. I mean, I'm not the most interactive on that show, but where you have to, you know, think on your feet a bit, I pull it back a bit and I'll laugh at other people's jokes about whatever it is. You know, I'm not... And then when I'm doing an interview with someone, then I'm, well, like I am now. But sure. As you point out, it's not
you
exactly
are a little bit,
how I am off stage.
Yes, sure. So... when you were creating the character of Milton, how did that come about? Do you start off doing jokes as yourself that you'd written? In what kind of context were you doing? Just sort of open mic things? What drove you to start?
When I started years ago, 20 odd years ago, the circuit was quite a different place. And there were far less opportunities of doing stuff. And it was all about doing open spots. But each open spot, I would do a slightly different character, but similar material. And I'd use a Welsh accent, or I'd put on a massive stomach, or
two classics on the open mic circuit. If you don't, you either go Welsh or you go stomach.
Yeah, so I just play around with it, and gradually I found a level that worked best, and didn't mean that I had to carry loads of props around with me. Just sort of have hair wax will travel.
Sure.
That's all I needed. And so it gradually evolved, but it was important to be a moving object in order to find that evolution.
Yes. I mean, I remember seeing you at gigs maybe 7 or 8 years ago, at a particular one I remember at the boat show at the Tattersall Castle, when you really surprised me, because I think I'd seen you before just doing the one-liners, and this was in a much more sort of Friday night club environment, in which you improvised loads, and you managed to improvise within the persona of Milton, so that it didn't feel jarring at all. But I only knew you as a one-liner person. How much of that improvisation came through, or were you doing more than a list of jokes?
I've got better at improvising over the years. The nice thing about the character is that, you know, it gives you a bit of time if you pull a face, and you've got some time to think, and you know the comeback might be one word, because that's the character, or two words, or if the worst comes to the worst, you can just weird it up and, you know, go and move on. So I've developed confidence in that. What's hard for me to do is do something like you can do really well. It's like MC, something like that. It's like, you know, be high energy and get a crowd going and interact and be genial and get... That's difficult for that persona to do. I do try it sometimes, but it's not really right, me running a show and the main person everyone sees in the middle is a bit weird. That doesn't really work for a show. But I like to think if there's energy in the room, I mean, I'll take heckles all day, really. I quite enjoy that. What's hard for me is a dead room.
Yes.
When there's no energy there to surf in the first place.
Okay.
So
what strategies do you have for dealing with heckles?
Usually the best way of dealing with a heckler, I think, is always to find something in what the heckler has said to kill themselves, to use their own weight against them.
Okay.
We all have a number of bullets in our gun that we're going to use should it come to it.
Sure.
But I always like, you know, they've spent 10 minutes thinking, what shall I shout, what shall I shout, what shall I shout? And then they shout it, and they're not expecting you to say, well, what do you mean by that exactly?
Yes.
And suddenly the playing field is entirely level and the audience are on your side.
Yes.
So, you know, and also hecklers don't expect you to be nice to them.
Okay.
And they're not quite sure.
They're imagining a combative environment where they're going to fight you and take you down.
Something. Yeah, so if you say thank you very much or whatever it is, and they're not sure then if you're being sarcastic, and the audience don't know. You can play around with the whole relationship dynamics in a more interesting way, I think, than just going slam.
Sure.
I mean, there are occasions for that when someone keeps on coming and they're drunk, you know. But I much prefer to use their own weight against them.
And I'm trying to think of several questions at once. When you first started out in comedy, did you have any kind of pre-prepared heckling material? Had you thought, I'd better have something to say?
I knew I should, but I didn't. Okay. And well, that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, I was always pretty against trying to use, you know, there are a number of heckle put-downs that we all know that sort of everyone, or a lot of people use. Sure. And yes, you can use those. And I have even delved into those, you know, when I first started. But I was determined to find my own way of dealing with that. Mm-hmm. And I was gradually, over the years, I've written things. Heckle put-downs get written best when you're heckled in a show and you've no idea how to deal with it. Mm. And you're going home, you think, right, next time I'm going to be so ready for that. And the adrenaline of that moment makes you come up with something. And, you know, enough of those failures over the years means you have quite an arsenal to throw at the next heckler.
Sure.
But as I say, I do prefer just seeing what happens if we talk to them.
I remember it puts me in mind of a story I heard about Harry Hill, who, again, inhabits an unusual world and ended up developing the heckle, not even a put down, but a line to deal with heckles, where he'd say, you can say what you like about me, sir, but I know when I get home, I've got a lovely chicken in the oven. Yeah. Which would just kind of, again, it leaves them with nowhere to go.
Exactly,
I think what I really enjoyed about watching you deal with hecklers the few times I've seen it is that you do have a kind of back and forth relationship with them. And I think that's the last thing they expect, because you're not someone who comes on in a combative way.
Yeah, yeah.
You sort of, it's almost like Tai Chi.
Yes. Yes, although I heard someone say it's a really subtle form of bullying. But there is that. It depends what they're like as well. And also because I'm lucky in that the demographic of my shows is kids and all sorts. Mm. So suddenly a child will shout out, you forgot to do the bit earlier or whatever it is. So it would be wrong to go in and slam them anyway. And it's, you know, and the whole room suddenly freezes slightly because they realise you're dealing with an 8-year-old.
Sure.
And you've got to be nice in that situation. But it would be great if you and them can find something weird together.
Yes.
That everyone can love.
Yes.
And you've got to go down that road a bit, you know, ask them about school or if they're on holiday, whatever it is. And then the bits of the shows that people remember, surely, aren't always the pre-prepared material that we've spent hours and hours on. Mm. But the things that happened on that night that only could have happened on that night and were magical. You needed the pre-prepared stuff to get there.
Yeah.
But the magic that happened on the night is what everyone will walk away with.
There's an incredibly generous attitude to want to regard. I mean, I know a lot of comedians don't like performing in rooms full of children. When I saw your show the other night, I was really surprised by how many young people there were. But that shows a real generosity of spirit, I think, to want to not just crush them and get on with it, but actually go, okay, let's see where this can go.
It's quite a fine line, though, because quite often people freeze when you talk to them and you don't want to look like you're hurting them. And you've got to see if this is going to work. Okay, we'll move on to something else.
Sure.
You know, to tease something out. I did a show a few years ago now. It was in Edinburgh, actually, and this girl shouted out something. I forget what it was, and it was just a little chat. And then at the end, I went back to her and I said, so, Rebecca, did you enjoy the show? And her mum said, she's asleep. There's no comeback, and that fortunately or unfortunately is what people probably remember from that show.
Sure. And were you thinking in the car on the way back next time
I'll stay for something to throw at her.
Do you have certain, given that there are children in the audience and even without taking that into concern, do you have certain rules about what the character of Milton Jones will or won't say, or the things that are in his or your life?
Yes, I mean, some of it's unconscious, but I don't swear because that's part of the world that I've created, and I wanted it to be accessible to my own children and everyone else, as many as possible. I wouldn't very often break out of the skin and say, this is just a gig and I'm being paid for it. You know, I wouldn't come out and say, hey, I'm just a comedian. Mm. I would try and make people believe that I thought everything I was saying was true. So, you know, Gary Delaney's way of doing one-liners, he's a very good one-liner comedian, is to say, look, folks, here's some jokes. You'll like some of them. You won't like others. Here we go.
Sure.
And that's the way he does it. But the persona thing, hopefully, I know people suspend their disbelief, but hopefully people believe what I'm saying at that moment. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it funny.
Mm. So do you see yourself, it's interesting you mentioned Gary, and obviously Tim Vine is the other sort of famous one-liner merchant. Do you see yourself in the context of other people that do one-liners?
I think you could draw a great big family tree or Venn diagram, couldn't you, of comedians and who overlaps with who. And but me, Tim, Stuart Francis, Jimmy Carr, Gary Delaney, we all slightly overlap and we're indifferent. What's interesting, I think, about one-liners is in order to get away with them, I think we all use a form of misdirection.
Okay.
In that, say, Tim, if you're familiar with Tim Vine, he'll do a very sort of entertainery sort of way. And that's his way of dealing with it. Jimmy does the persona thing as well, but a slightly darker way.
It's incredible to think of you and Jimmy Carr in the same sentence even, but you are doing a similar sort of subterfuge.
If you look at the words that we use, they're pretty similar, actually.
Not all of the words.
No, not all of the words. Yeah. That's true. Stuart Francis is another one. Mm-hmm. He sort of uses a slightly urbane Canadian drawl. Mm-hmm. But it's slightly odd for us to watch each other because we know that there will be some overlap in thought. Mm-hmm. And he'll have one that I'll have either not come up with yet or I have got exactly the same punchline. Mm-hmm. And so it's a slightly painful process to watch each other sometimes, even though we actually all get on with each other.
Mm-hmm. Have there been conversations where you've had to say, you know, you've got to put your hand up and go, I've kind of covered
absolutely
that?
Every time I see Tim, every time I see Stuart, basically. And we're quite often phoning each other and said, you know, if we've got a new line, say, have you got something that goes like this? And then we go yes or no or whatever it is, or just say yes anyways.
What was it again? I have now.
Exactly. So, but we all get on quite, we're never on the same bill, of course.
Yes.
Because people have the one-liner man, and that you'll only have, unless it's a benefit, in which case we all try and avoid each other. Or get on first, that's the thing.
Yes, I really must go and look after the kids, yeah. So I wondered as well something about the rhythm. We were talking about the way that your persona and the personas of all those different comics allows them. What is that that allows you to do that? The fact of Jimmy's take on the world and Stuart's drawl and your, I don't want to use the word idiocy, but apparent idiocy. What is it exactly that you said it kind of buys you some time, but can we go into that a bit further? What does it do that you wouldn't be able to do if you just, because the jokes are strong enough, surely, that you could walk on and do the jokes.
Well, you say that. I remember once I was announced at a club and I wasn't ready. And my hair was down, and I just heard my name, and I had to run out on the stage and do the same jokes. And this was a number of years ago now. And I felt I could hear the audience thinking, these are just puns, really, aren't they? And I mean, it wasn't as bad as that.
Sure.
But I suppose I need to dress up to get into battle.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps me say, right now I am playing a character. Mm-hmm. But also, hopefully, the character signposts towards a whole world. And you can't do that if you don't have some kind of visual stimulus, I don't think.
Okay.
Whether it be just in the acting of it or some kind of shirt or prop or something.
Sure.
So there are degrees of it. And, you know, I think I can do it with just my eyes. But is that a train? hopefully it's to draw people into a world, a bigger thing.
Sure. That aspect of the visual, I think, is very important in your work, and it's what stops it from being, or it separates it from being puns or pun-based. There are some puns in your jokes, but a lot more are kind of, I'm sure I'm not the first person to draw the similarity with the Far Side cartoons, where it's a whole visual picture. It's a one-panel idea. I was looking at one of yours on your Twitter feed earlier on. The joke was, I must apologies to the bee who earlier on I shouted, get a job at. Was it apologies to the bee? Apologies to the wasp.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that was it. Apologies to the bee that I shouted to get a job at. I thought you were a wasp.
Yes.
Got there in the end.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Well, hopefully. I mean, what is art if it isn't looking at something and trying to change people's perception of it? So that even though they're just jokes in a way, if I am walking along and I see a handkerchief on the ground, me as comedian who earns a living from that, I'm thinking, there's a handkerchief on the ground. What does that look like? What other way could I express that could surprise people? Thinking, mulling, may take weeks, may take months. Some of the stuff I've had takes years. Then suddenly, I've booked a room with some people in it who've paid for tickets, and I've got these ideas written down, and the adrenaline of that makes me think, I was walking along the other day, and on the road I saw a small dead baby ghost. Although thinking about it, it might have been a handkerchief. So I'm constantly on the lookout for visual puns, if you like.
Yes.
Or there's something today.
Your visual puns is an interesting way of looking at it, because it's a play on images rather than a play on words.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. I think there's a technical word for it. I'm not sure what it is exactly. But and then, you know, there was a sign I saw the other day saying burlesque only. I thought, isn't he in prison in Italy yet? So you're kind of constantly looking for stuff, but then you're thinking, well, in what context could I put that in? Sometimes, so I make a little note, and lots of it, I throw away about 9 out of 10 of those.
Okay.
But because I do bits of radio and bits of telly and bits of writing, eventually I'll fit most of them in somewhere.
Do you find out of the different things that you do, that the different creative things you do, do you find that stand-up is the hardest discipline? Is it a case of, if it doesn't work on stand-up, it might work in something else? Because, I mean, I can see it happening that way around, but you're unlikely to look at something that isn't quite right for radio and think, it'll probably work on stage.
Yes. I think there's if it doesn't work on stage, I want to know the reason why it doesn't work. I mean, it might be an audio joke of some kind that works far better on the radio.
Okay.
There are those jokes. But I think there's a danger of watering down stuff and thinking this is all great. Well, you know what it's like if you haven't done a gig for a month or two. It takes a while to get your sharpness back.
Mm-hmm.
And mentally, writing-wise, it takes a while to get your sharpness back if you're not writing for stand-up. And even doing my own tour, I did a week end at the Comedy Store about 18 months ago. And I looked at some of my tour material and I thought, nah, not going to use that.
Okay.
Because it's a Comedy Store and you need to be doing your A game. And I've suddenly realised that a lot of my tour stuff wasn't my A game.
Okay.
And so,
apologies to anyone who bought £5 a ticket.
When I say A game, that I wouldn't do that at a late show at the Comedy Store. There are sort of more playful and whimsical things maybe that sure. would be in a tour show. But it's horses for courses, I think, and some things are... But it's really easy to kid yourself. It's like being fit. If you just go on runs by yourself, mm-hmm. you can think you're a brilliant sprinter.
Okay.
But as soon as you play for a team, you find out that maybe you're not as good as you thought you were.
Sure.
And being in a Comedy Store context where everyone's trying really hard, suddenly you realise what you've written, the quality of it.
It's interesting with someone who I imagine spends so much time writing as you, to hear that the moment of the pre-new material night adrenaline actually makes a difference to you. I know it makes a tremendous difference to me. I'm sort of casting around, go, God, I've got nothing. Mm. And the hour before the show, you sit and you write... the nothing, from the bits and bobs, from the notes, you write some jokes and then they work. And you're like, oh, God, I could have done that at 9 o'clock Monday morning and then I wouldn't have been worrying all week.
But I find that if I had done that at 9 o'clock on Monday morning and I produced pages and pages, so much of it would have been rubbish because I hadn't got the adrenaline of the moment. There's something about seeing people filing into a room that you just go, that won't work. That maybe, you'd know. Yes, yes, right, and I'll do that. Oh, and I've thought of something else that I've just seen over there because I'm living in that moment of you're going to do it now.
Yes.
And you need those moments. You know, you could take a year off to write a new show, but if you didn't perform in that year, you'd probably end up with a rubbish show.
Sure.
I would, anyway.
Just to use the example of the hanky / small dead baby ghost joke, what was the timing of the creation of that joke in terms of you seeing it? Did you make a note of it, or did it just sort of roll around your head for a while? And when did you first commit it to paper, and when did you first commit it to the stage?
I can't remember on that one, because that's quite an old joke in a way from my... but some of them are really instant. Some of them seem to drop fully formed into your head. But for every one of those, there are 100 other ones that have been on my back burner for possibly 10 years.
And is that what form does that take? Do you have kind of notebooks and catalogues? What sort of...
It's a file on my computer, basically.
Okay.
And I'll write half ideas down. And there was another one today that someone said, I'm off to Bournemouth, my mum's Hawaii. I thought, what a strange way to tell everyone your mum's Hawaii. Anyway, as I say, most of these I throw away. But you're always trying to see things from another direction. And, you know, some, and also because the one-liner, if it's over three lines, mm-hmm. it's too long for me. So I'm literally shaving syllables off.
Okay.
And because when it works, I think what I do is I put a silly cartoon in people's head that may have a surprise ending.
Sure.
Sometimes the idea is right, but the communication isn't. And you, by just reversing it or putting an extra word on or changing the rhythm, you can make it work. So I've lots of ideas that I've tried out once or twice, but I haven't thrown them away. I've just put them in the different part of a file to try again when I come to them fresh.
So this is Milton. This was a really fun interview, but we also got some deeper stuff from Milton as well. You've heard a lot on persona already in this episode, but later we'll be talking about the visual paradigm of some of his jokes, changing, correcting the picture rather than the puns, almost like visual puns, a lot of Milton's material, as well as some fascinating stuff on the way that Mock the Week is made and Milton's rather unique role in that process. And we're also edging ever closer to uncovering Milton's origin story. I must apologise for the noise around me. I'm recording this in a small cafe. I don't know if you've noticed this, but what we've been getting over the last year or so is gradually less of what I was originally searching for, a kind of slot A, tab B approach to joke writing and how that process works. And we're getting more of a holistic sense of how a creative person operates. I mean, the frustrating thing, obviously, is that any of these interviews could last forever, and we always have to curtail them, but that's just the world, isn't it? But I've noticed, and I don't know if I've said this before, but I've definitely started to find a difference in the way I'm writing stand-up as a result of doing this show. And I hope it's doing the same for you. Thank you for all of your donations thus far. I really appreciate them. And I have just recently had the final settlement back from the run of Comedians Comedian that we did at the Edinburgh Festival this year, of which so many of the most recent episodes have been taken. And I'm very pleased to say that I really need your donations. I had a lot of fun at Edinburgh. I worked really hard. We've got loads and loads of interviews done and produced a great big wadge of material that will continue to crash towards you for some time. But a smash and grab, it was not. I'll be paying through the nose for some time, and if you'd like to help me pay through the nose, you can definitely do that. If you've enjoyed this and any other episodes, if they've made a small difference to the way you view your own process or the way you watch your favourite comedians on the telly or in the clubs, then a donation of any size would be much appreciated via the website comedianscomedian.com. Just click on the PayPal button. You can decide how much you want to pay. So far, we've had donations ranging from £5 to, bless your heart, £50. I don't expect 50 quid from everyone, but if you can afford to pay for it, then I really appreciate it, because this business is... It was operating at a sort of a mild loss, and since Edinburgh, it is operating at an enormous loss. So if you'd like to help out the show, please do so. If you're unable to, I've had a couple of students writing to me, people who haven't got any money. I totally understand. There's no obligation. If you can do, if you'd like to, go to the website and click on PayPal. So merchandise update. There isn't any merchandise. I quite fancy doing a hat or something comedian-y certainly. I thought maybe a satchel or possibly a do not disturb hanger for a hotel door that says busy writing on one side and on the other side crying into the sink. Or possibly not the word crying, possibly something else. Tweet me your amusing ideas for ComComPod merch to @ComComPod using the hashtag #PenniesFromHeaven. So that's all for now. Some little advertising blurbs and stuff at the end. And now I shall return you to the wonderful Milton Jones. Talking about the process of writing, I wanted to talk a bit about the assemblage of your material and how you structure a 20-minute set or a 7-minute, or and how you structure an hour. Because something I noticed from your show that I saw the other night, I kind of gradually became aware, because I was sort of searching for it, I was kind of looking at it critically, in a positive way. God, this is awful. I was aware of how the links started to help the setups. Because there's so much misdirection involved, you told a story which began with a joke about parachuting and a cagoule, And then you, I don't want to sort of spoil any of these, and often I can't remember the sheer volume of them, but then you, and then in the story, you walk into a forest, and being in a forest helps you do your next joke, which is about butterflies in your stomach.
Yeah.
But we're expecting it to be butterflies in your stomach as the payoff a lot less, because we've just seen you walk into a forest.
Yeah, yeah.
So the misdirection is superb in that case, because we think we're following an actual story that keeps shifting paradigm. We keep changing the frame over and over again.
Well, the worst thing that can happen is the audience are ahead of you.
Yes.
So I wouldn't prepare for a 10 minutes or 15 minutes. I'd be happy to do gag, gag, gag. But after about that, people then think, oh, I see how this works. Or subconsciously they do.
Okay.
And they begin to get ahead of you. So, and also after about 15 minutes, you can see blood coming out of people's ears. Because it's too much information and you can see them, you know, zoning out a bit. So... as you saw, I've got an overhead projector, I've got bits of music, I've got anything.
It's lovely to see an overhead projector, especially in a room that size in 2013.
Well, you've either got to go high-tech or low-tech, haven't you? So I had to go low-tech. But yes, you don't have to vary the angle of attack, because people get used to it and can see it coming. So anything to try and shift things around. But I can't change style. I remember I did some touring with Rory Bremner years ago, and he did 10 minutes without impressions.
Okay.
And you could feel the audience going, what? I didn't pay for this. Yeah. You know, it's great stand-up, but, you know, they want what they want.
Yes.
And they've seen me do one-liners, so I've got to kind of do that, but try and make them different. Mm-hmm. They don't want to hear the old jokes, particularly. Mm-hmm. Well, some people do. But they want it presented in a way in which surprises them. And an hour and a half show, it's harder and harder to surprise them as the show goes on. So you've got to, and also they become more weary, I think.
When you say that you don't do jokes, when three lines is too long for you, you don't do jokes longer than three lines, have you ever tried that? Have you tried doing stand-up with a longer form?
Not really. Initially, I got into one-liners because I was so terrified of being on stage. I had to get to the joke as quickly as possible. And so you end up with a one-liner, effectively. And so gradually I got pigeonholed for doing that, and I suppose, yeah, I'm a one-liner man. But no, it's never really worked for me. I don't do whimsy particularly. I tend to need a joke. I need a joke thing to make me laugh. And if I can do some whimsy on the way, that's great, but it feels a bit like eating lots of pastry with no meat to me, whimsy.
Okay. The meat being the punchline. It's got to have something that can work in a club on a Saturday night as well.
I want to go, ha, not,
I see what you mean, as an audience member.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you've got to do what sort of makes you laugh, I think.
Okay.
I think.
So when you're putting together and I noticed in some of your previous work, there's the joke about, you know, my other grandfather, my other grandfather. Is that a sort of, do you kind of go, okay, these jokes are all about, you know, I've got 100 jokes here, 10 of them could be about a man or a grandfather, so I'll scoop those together for the sake of memory?
Yeah, partly memory, and partly so that it looks more natural. I mean, they do sort of clunk together, but I'll have all my relationship jokes together. I have all my school jokes together.
Okay.
I think the audience, you know, makes it feel slightly less tiring if, it, you know, there appears to be a subject holding things together.
Okay.
The valuable jokes to me are the ones like my grandfather ones that can be runners.
Sure.
That can sort of act as a rod through the madness.
Yes.
And I've got several different ones of those. But when I find one of those, because by definition, they're two or three jokes in themselves.
Okay.
Those are the ones that are really useful.
Okay. I'm really kind of nerding out over the minutiae of the technical process here, but we might come back to that again in a moment. I wanted to ask whether you consider yourself to be an artist or an entertainer.
Oh. Actually, I wouldn't use either word. I mean, I suppose someone might, in a broad sense. Entertainer seems to smack of old school, doesn't it?
Sure. And,
or children's entertainer, which maybe I am. And artist seems a bit too pretentious somehow. I like, and it's not my phrase, but clown for adults.
Okay. That does have connotations, which I think some people might have picked up on.
Yes. But you know what I mean? It's not going to change your political philosophy. It's not going to make you change direction in your life particularly. Mm-hmm. But if it works and if you like it, it will give you some kind of escapist joy for an hour.
And is that important to you, to give people joy? Is that what's the main drive underneath your wanting to get people to laugh? Is it purely a sort of a selfish, you enjoy the experience? Or is it, how important is it to you that there's an element of joy, that there's some element of...
I don't wake up in the morning thinking, oh, I'd love to give some people joy this evening. But
given that it's, you know, yeah. I mean, I think you get used to, over time, you get used to people laughing.
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of different elements to that. I like making people laugh, and that gives me the adrenaline to want to do it. And I'm lucky to be able to get to be at a time when comedy is popular and we can get paid to do it. Mm-hmm. That's great. On the other hand, it can become addictive in a slightly weird way. I think you get addicted to adrenaline as much as anything. So even on a night off, at about 9 o'clock, I'm feeling twitchy.
Sure.
Because my body's used to, come on. Or even when you take a night off, you know, you go to a friend's party or something. This is boring. You get bored, really. Well, I do. You go, come on, I'm not the centre of attention.
Is that it? Because I think a lot of comedians fall prey to that. You see a lot of comedians storming the conversation.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. No, that
is that true. Something you do? I can't quite imagine that.
No, well, thank you. I don't think I'm that kind of person. There are two types of comedian, aren't there? There's the person who's on all the time and is great for half an hour, but painful to share a car journey with.
Think of examples in your own head.
Yes, yeah. And then there's the other type, which I hope I'm more like, who's just one person off stage and one person on stage, although there is a tiny overlap. Mm-hmm. And for a start, in real life, I couldn't be that intense with what I was saying or have that much meaning. So, I can't be like that off stage. But because my body's addicted to the adrenaline and I'm used to being the centre of attention, if I'm at a dull party, it really annoys me.
And what steps do you take?
Well, it depends. It depends who and where. But I do find myself not winding up people for the sake of it, but just trying to make something happen.
Okay.
Which is a bit sad, I suppose. But just because, I'm used to things happening and rooms trying, you know. I suppose you feel a slightly subconscious responsibility to make something happen in the room.
Okay.
Because that's what our job is, after
sure.
all. And if not much is happening, then we failed in some way. I mean,
do you think there's a parallel there with? And I don't want to put words into your mouth. Maybe the answer is no. But something that I feel, that I think a lot of comedians feel, is a sense of needing to put oneself into a situation to make sure everything's all right. I think a lot of the reason why I end up sort of emceeing a lot and being the sort of, you know, warm comic, that you were talking about earlier on. Is out of a sort of a desire for things not to be awkward that borders on the kind of the pathological. You're just kind of like, oh, no one's talking, I'd better talk. And as a result, I end up over talking and, you know, being sort of risking being boorish. Is there some sort of connection there with what you feel needs to be happening in a room? If you say there's a certain twitchiness or a boredom with the normal.
I don't know so much about it. I don't think I'm that type of person. I'd more likely shrink to the wall and think to myself. But I certainly think it's true that when I was starting off, I was really nervous. So my way of coping with it was to look really, really nervous.
Okay.
And that's partly how the character came out, you know. So that when I go to the camera in Mock the Week, whatever, I look slightly terrified because that's what I was like inside when I started.
Sure.
So my way of dealing with it is to make it really, really bad.
Okay.
Rather than try and make it better in a strange way. But again, to make something happen, but to take the rubbish on myself. And, I mean, this is getting a bit psychological, but I had an older brother, younger brother. Why did I say older? Well, that's Freudian in itself, but who was brilliant at everything.
Okay.
Straight A's, head girl, everything. And and one of the ways I found out that I could get some attention, and I tried work-wise and academic-wise, I couldn't, I was fine, I was in the middle, he took all his exams a year early and all this stuff, you know, was to mess about.
Sure.
And you get far more attention if you instead of coming third on sports day, you drop your trousers halfway down the track.
Is that based on a real event?
Not exactly, but I'm using it as a sort of analogy. But certainly, I got to a stage where I deliberately mess up work for the comments, you know, you are a joke or whatever it was written at the end of the essay. Mm. Because I knew that if I tried my best, no one would notice. And gradually that's turned around, you know. I've sort of turned it, kept going and been around at a time where that can be paid. So I've been lucky in that sense. But that's sort of one of my motivations, is to get the attention back to me by messing up the chessboard.
Yes, okay. And do you think there's... We were talking earlier on about how you play, how the character of Milton plays with others on something like Mock the Week. Mm. Does that ever come into the work that you do on there? Is there a... There seems to be a parallel with sort of if you're surrounded by overachievers and people being fast and zappy and charismatic and...
Yeah, absolutely. And what happens is, of course, they take a subject and they all riff with it. And they go like, you know, and Chris goes one and Hugh goes two and Dara goes three and I say pheasant. Which is slightly annoying for them. But the editor loves it because she can just cut there and move on to the next subject.
Sure, sure.
So that has sort of worked for me. I mean, it's not team playing. but I mean, given that the other problem with Mock the Week is getting a word in the first place, I'm lucky in that I can get in, track a grenade and get out again very quickly because of the way I do things. Mm-hmm. And that has been really handy, you know, for telly whenever I'd had the opportunity because I get to the jokes really quickly. What's harder for me to do is to do a longer show, but that's, you know,
sure.
They don't know that.
The question I was going to ask, and this might be a bit of a curveball, is I noticed that some of your jokes, because of the kind of the cartoon world they inhibit, because of the necessity of using broad subjects that we all recognise to bounce off, I wondered if something like you did a joke which, and I don't remember the exact joke, but I made a note of it at the time, that it was something to do with women taking a long time to get ready. Do you think that there is, I think it was when you were riffing with someone from Manchester or someone.
No, the joke is travelling around, I didn't realise, you find out a bit about the histories about different places. Years ago, all the men in Chester went to live in Manchester, and centuries ago, all the women in Chester, well, they're still getting ready.
Yeah. Now, do you think, although that's an excellent joke, do you think there is any sort of danger of perpetuating stereotypes because you have to use stereotypes as your language?
Yeah, there is. And one of my only defences is probably the same as Frankie Boyle's, actually, ironically, is that as long as I do it to everyone... then hopefully it's okay. I mean, there are moments where it's slightly dangerous, I think. And I usually try and balance it out, either by putting, you know, in that case, there isn't an anti-men thing on the end of it. But there is another joke in the show about lads, when you're ever asked to do a job, do you deliberately do it really badly? So you never get asked to do that job again. I mean, I hardly know CPR anyway. So, I mean, I think the danger with taking one joke out of context is that it doesn't give the spirit in which it's said away.
Sure.
Which is always the bane of the Daily Mail, as far as I'm concerned, and newspapers in general, where they take what was said on a programme,
yes,
even though they didn't actually watch it, and then they present it to Guildford or Tunbridge Wells and say, what do you think of this?
Yes.
And no one sees the spirit in which it's said. Now, having said that, it might have been said in a horrible way anyway. But hopefully, the whole spirit of the show trumps any particular potentially nasty thing that was said.
Sure.
I hope. And I've offended people... lots of times
have
over
you,
the
years. Oh, yeah. That's something I wanted to ask. What kind of, I wrote down, what kind of complaints do you get? And I underlined the word you, as if to say, even you, surely, I mean.
Well, I mean, I could go on. It's usually there's a mistake happens. I mean, there was once I was in a rugby club, and I was doing some jokes about sheep, and I forget what they were, and someone shouted out, "There's nothing wrong with sheep," and I said, "I know, I've seen your wife." Right? Just, you have a fraction of a second and you just say what comes into your head.
And it should be said that although now in the afternoon that drew an ooh, that's exactly what you need to say to survive in a commercial.
However, when I looked over, there was the bloke who said it with his wife in a wheelchair and a drip.
Right.
I'm going, oh boy. block it out. Just carry on with the rest of the show. And you know, I didn't get into trouble for that particular thing, but I could just see their faces fall when I'd done it. And going, because
they're assuming almost too much thought on your part.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, there's no point in me trying to explain that or ruining the show and going over, I'm so sorry, or, you know, it just happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, there's another one I've told quite a lot.
Yes, I'm familiar, but this is the rugby club that you had to leave.
Yeah.
Was it a dinner you said something about?
There are a lot of them.
Yeah.
the other one that I've told quite a lot is being at some bar men and women had a corporate thing, and halfway through, I was doing fine, there was no need to get involved. I said, so this is your night off. Strange, isn't it? On your night off, you've got free food and drink. Surely you get that all the time when you're at work. And a woman shouted out, "We don't get free food and drink at work." And I said, "How come you're all so fat then?"
Tell me, Milton, had you looked at this woman before you said that?
No, I wish I had. Well, I couldn't see her because I didn't realise that that was her particular problem. And she stormed out screaming, crying. And, yeah, well, well, that's what some of the blokes did. They laughed. They thought it was hilarious. But, of course, all her friends at the back didn't. And I'm going, I didn't know.
And the fact that the guys had laughed at it.
Yeah, made it 10 times worse.
Like
playing to them. And then, of course, the promoter, I think I died at that point, after that. And the promoter came to me and said, "You're not having your money, mate. You can only have half of it." And then some blokes surrounded me and said, "She's crying in the other room. You go and apologise." And I go, "Well, I'm trying to explain about comedy and how you can't actually plan what's going to be said and all this stuff." And the promoter just gave me half money. He said, "Run to the car. Just run to the car, mate." And so I walked briskly into the car. But that's the kind of situation you can find yourself in, you know, that things happen. And it's not because you pre-planned to be nasty, particularly. It's just because sometimes things look bad.
And it's very difficult, given... I mean, you could be forgiven for thinking, "Come on, you bastards, look at all the nice stuff I've just done. Look how there's no swearing in it and there's no victim in a lot of it." And yet, as soon as that bomb happens, that's...
Well, sometimes, I'm to blame in that... I remember I did another trade union congress, which was a bad thing to do anyway. And I used to have a joke that goes... I'm not sure this will work on the podcast, but it goes... I used to go out with a girl who was, you know, deformed. For the podcast, that's wiggly hand movement. Yes. And for the first time in my life, despite having done that joke hundreds of times, I forgot to do the hand movement. So basically I said, I used to go out with a girl who was, you know, deformed. And there was no point explaining that. No, normally what happens is, and then I started getting heckled from all sorts. You know, imagine trade union congress, how much they'd love that. And, and then I couldn't get my money and I ended up missing the last train. It was a great night. But there are lots of little stories like that that often, you know, they're at the beginning of your career and that would mean I'd never miss that joke out again, you know, that I would get that right. And often you learn more from the things that go wrong.
Mm. Is there anyone who would like to ask a question? That's a great question. We were talking about the change in your persona and how you can switch that on or off. Can you do that with the joke writing machine, the pun factory in your brain?
In a short answer, no. I'm afraid it's a life affliction. And it sort of got to be the way, because you think, okay, take 3 weeks off and go and have a villa or something somewhere and just turn your head off. But what happens there is that I get relaxed and creative.
Yes.
And it's counterproductive, actually, in some way. So, no, I can't. And my family, you know, are used to me doing that or used to me trying jokes out on them, you know, all the time. And they found out now, of course, that there's money involved and they try and sell me jokes.
Do any of those make it to the stage?
Well, yeah, now my kids are a bit older now, but there was a time when Jeremy, he was about eight, and he said, "Dad, can you use this? Can you use this? Is it just me, or does the Queen's face look like a coin?" No, I can't, son.
And no money for you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there was another time he did a joke. He said, "Oh, you can use this and use this." And I did a radio sketch about a commentator, and the line was something. I had to adapt it a little bit. It's really easy to be a commentator because their names are on their backs. All you have to do is read them on their shirts. And it's Vodafone, passes to Vodafone, passes to Vodafone. And it's a nice little joke on the way to something. And then he was in the recording of the radio, and he's only eight. He came running up to me afterwards. We put his name on the credits at the end of the show. And he came up running up to me and he said, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy, there was a man with the same name as me on the end of the credits."
No repeat fees for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Fantastic. Anyone else? When you run your fingers through your hair, is that genuine nerves or part of the persona?
I think it's to try and make sure it's sticking up a bit. I think that's all that is. It's not a conscious thing a lot of the time. It just happens, and I try and play with it to make it stick up. I don't like the idea of it looking completely normal. I like the idea of it, like the shirt thing, being, nah, shouldn't be like that. But not. I don't particularly like the sort of, like I've stuck my fingers in a socket idea. It just needs to be, so I'm kind of going, still a bit odd, aren't I? Yeah. So I think that's it.
How much? Oh, someone liked that question over there. Yeah. Some appreciation from mobile phone. How much? And we won't tell anyone apart from the listenership of the podcast. How much of Mock the Week is scripted?
I always compare Mock the Week to doing like an exam, where you know what questions could come up, but you kind of hope the one that you revised comes up. It's recorded for 3 hours, up to 3 hours for a half-hour show, so most of it ends up on the cutting room floor. And you hope that your funny bits don't end up there.
Just pheasant on the
Yes. So basically, we get a long, long list of stuff that could come up, and there will be one or two that definitely come up, but the edit is king. If someone says something really funny, or two or three people say something really funny on subject four or five, we may well start with that in the edit, in the final programme. So what's dangerous with a three-hour record is that you zone out for 10 minutes. Mm. And I find myself thinking, I'm thinking about something else. I haven't said anything for 10 minutes. I hope this isn't the bit that goes in the show. Mm. So it's the stand-up, we know roughly what's coming. But again, we have to prepare two or three. And the scenes at the end, we know roughly what's coming. The single biggest thing that's hard on Mock the Week is getting in before someone else. Because even if you know what subject's coming up, there are probably only two or three ways of tackling it comedically, but there are seven people in the room. So the first three are going to get in first and to do it. I mean, my style's slightly different, so that helps. But even so, especially, it's easier without Frankie, to be honest. Because he was brilliant at what he did, but it's really hard to come in with a nice little joke after he's just gone blat. Yeah. With darkness.
Yeah.
Having said that, I didn't really work with Frankie particularly, but anyone who does that, you know, type of thing is harder. So it's sort of scripted, but the script is so huge. Or it's not scripted. The subject headings are scripted, but it's so huge you could never cover it anyway. So you kind of got to keep your fingers crossed that it, you know, your bits win out. It can do, but as I say, I prefer interaction to indifference. And quite often with my own show, it's in a theatre, and it isn't the same kind of combative environment. And to be honest, the bits that I look forward to are the interjections of the audience and seeing whether I can cope with that. Especially, I've done the show that I'm doing at the moment, you know, about 80 times. So, you know, sometimes I find myself floating up in the sky and looking down on myself. Not that joke again. So I'm quite happy in that situation with my own show to invite anyone to chip in. And there's not, you know, sometimes I regret that, but it's the risk you take. I wouldn't probably do that in a club environment, to be fair.
I think we've just got time for one more before we have to wrap up. In the terms of the writing process, what sort of things are you using to try and find your starting points? Are you constantly reading and listening to the radio and reading magazines and newspapers?
Obviously, with something like Mock the Week, I have to look at newspapers and websites and all that stuff. But they do provide a massive, great briefing document, which I don't read at all. I just look at the potential subject headings and think, have you got anything? Because I'm coming in at a sideways thing anyway.
Sure.
There's no point in me doing an Andy Parsons or a David Mitchell rant.
Okay.
You know, I'll just do something vaguely related to it. So my homework, if you like, not for Mock the Week, but just in general, is to read lots, watch lots, and to just come up with pages on one subject. Just writing word association, anything that comes into my head, a flow of subconscious nonsense. And then I'll ring potential ideas on that page and throw most of them away, but keep the others. It's like panning for gold. You just keep going, keep going, keep going.
So you're churning out, like doing that. Is that the sort of exercise where you just don't let your pen off the paper for 10 minutes or something?
Yeah. And then try and hone it up. And especially on the day of a show, then really get it crisp. Yeah.
I think that's all we've got time for. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Mr. Milton Jones. So thank you to Milton. Thank you to James Peggs Lowy on sound and Pete Jones on camera. We'll be releasing the first episode of the ComCom Pod web TV show very soon. That's starring Susan Kalman. More details on that next time. That's sort of nearly-ish ready to go. I'm going to start to run a web TV show concurrently with the podcast so that you have the option of watching either. Probably the web one will be considerably shorter because people on the internet don't like to watch telly for more than about 12 minutes, as I understand it in my extremely limited research. But that's the plan. So more details on that soon. And hopefully the next podcast we release will be concurrent, if that's the word, will be attached to that. Hopefully they're all going to be happening soon. And just very quickly, a couple of hellos. Hello to Alex that I met at the brilliant Sunday Capers gig over the weekend. That's a part of a sort of concept mini city festival called Sunday Papers. A very nice atmosphere. And so lovely to meet Alex. And hello to Anna, who tweets for the BBC and who I met on the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who when I was fully latexed up, although not the way you'd expect from me. I was playing an oud serving drinks behind the bar on the fascinating series of decisions that was the after party show. Absolutely brilliant fun, as you can imagine. Best night of my life, standing behind several of my childhood heroes and pretending to serve them drinks whilst wearing a latex mask. Brilliant. Hello to Anna. Hello to Alex. Come and see some shonky new hours of stand-up from me and James Acaster on Wednesday the 18th of December at the Pleasance. If you saw Milton Jones on tour a couple of years ago, it's likely that James was his tour support. He's had a couple recently. I think Chris Martin's been doing some. He's fantastic. But if you saw him a few years ago, James Acaster, of course, you've heard from on this show before, and if you haven't, then he'd have been the one who looks like a school uniform on a coat hanger. Thank you for listening, everyone. You can help me claw my way out of my Edinburgh-induced poverty with a donation via comedianscomedian.com. We're back next time with something amazing. Bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.